CITR 101.9 FM presents News 101, Vancouver's volunteer-produced student and community newscast.
And now here's your host, Carrie Baptist.
Good evening. In the news this week, we bring you an update from provincial opposition critic for the Attorney General, Leonard Krogh, on the BC Rail scandal, the fallout from the HST harmonized sales tax proposal, and the throne speech. In environmental news, we'll also be talking to biologist with the Watershed Watch Salmon Society, Stan Probos, about the devastating drop in wild salmon numbers this year. Millions of salmon have unexpectedly disappeared from the Fraser River, threatening salmon stocks with collapse. And to round out the broadcast, we'll bring you an interview with Green Party leader Elizabeth May, speaking about her new book. We'll have all this, plus arts and your weather forecast, coming up this hour right here on News 101. Wild salmon stocks on the West Coast have been endangered and at risk for some time. Just last summer, stocks along the coast of California collapsed entirely due to poor management. This year, it looks like it's BC's turn to face the consequences of poor environmental stewardship. According to Burnaby New Westminster MP Peter Julian, we are seeing a collapse of stocks that is equal in magnitude on the economic and environmental front to the collapse of the cod fishery in Newfoundland and Labrador. Today, our own Megan Turcato is speaking with Watershed Watch Salmon Society biologist Stan Probos about the state of wild salmon in BC.
Hi, Stan.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good. So first, can you describe the situation right now with BC's wild salmon?
Well, if we specifically talk about the sockeye from the Fraser River, we've just got some information that the preseason forecast was approximately about 10.5 million. So 10.5 million sockeye were supposed to return this summer. And now more recent information has come in from the Pacific Salmon Commission and the Fisheries and Oceans Canada that only about 1.3 million are going to return. So there's a lot of sockeye missing, basically, and there's some theories out there as to what happened, but really there hasn't been any solid conclusions as to what happened to these sockeye.
So can you explain a little bit about what you believe is responsible for the massive drop in salmon numbers?
Yeah, there's a few theories. So just to give you some background on these fish and the story, they're two large producing sockeye lakes in the Fraser River Basin. One of them is the Chilco, and one of them is the Quesnel. And this run of salmon that was returning, or supposed to return this year, as juveniles, they were going and leaving the river in 2007. As juvenile fish salmon do, they go out into the ocean for several years and then return to spawn. Now, as they were leaving these lakes, especially Chilco, which is an extremely productive lake, Fisheries and Oceans Canada is able to get numbers and estimate numbers as to how many fish are leaving as juveniles. And they had some very large numbers. Actually, they were assuming that, or predicting 130 million juvenile fish were going to be leaving the Fraser. Now, that's a pretty good recent estimate in terms of the last 50 years. Now, subsequently, something happened after they left the place where they were being monitored around those two lake areas. And so what we thought would be a very productive return actually turned out to be quite a poor return, and Fisheries and Oceans Canada has not provided any concrete substantiated theories as to what went wrong. One of the theories is that something happened obviously between the time that they left those lakes and they're in the rivers and the time when they were in the ocean, their early marine phase. Something happened there. It could have been some sort of food limiting factor. Maybe there wasn't enough food for them at that time due to possible changes in temperature, which are related to food. That's one of the theories that's being bounced around. Maybe something happened in the river when they were actually migrating down. The Fraser River has experienced increasing temperatures in the last decade or so. And salmon are very sensitive to changes in temperature. It could have been a whole host of other things. It could have been a pollution event maybe in the river. So there's a lot of unknowns. There's also a theory that these fish may have been impacted by salmon farms during their out-migration in that time period.
Can you explain how fish farming practices could affect salmon numbers?
Sure. I mean, there's a lot of science out there internationally that has linked salmon farming with negative impacts on wild salmon. So there's been science conducted in Europe where there's salmon farming, and they've shown that salmon farms can produce sea lice, which are at unnatural levels in the environment, and then when wild salmon, juvenile fish, you know, the small fish, pass by these farms, they're actually infected by this unnatural source of sea lice, and at that stage in their development, they're susceptible to damage from the sea lice. So in the Georgia Strait and Johnstone Strait, salmon have to pass by approximately 30 active salmon farms. So that is a potential problem. I'm certainly not saying that that is the cause of this collapse. However, there is substantiated science that indicates Fraser sockeye have sea lice on them near farms in the Georgia Strait. And so it is of concern, and it should certainly be looked into. Just recently, there were some comments from Fisheries Oceans Canada in some newspapers that actually dismissed the negative impacts of farms with as a causal effect of some of the declines in the sockeye. And I don't think that's correct. I think when we look at this collapse, we need to look at every piece of information that's available, and we shouldn't be dismissing anything at this point in time.
Could the drop in this number of salmon levels in BC also be linked to drops in the salmon stocks all along the West Coast?
Certainly. There is probably. I wouldn't want to indicate that there is one single factor that's affecting the Fraser River's sockeye. I'm sure there are some large global mechanisms that are changing the way salmon have to deal with the environment, basically. And I'm referring to changes in global temperature. And that sort of thing would affect stocks on a greater scale.
So,
for example, the Skeena River system, which is a very large salmon-producing river, is also experiencing declines in returns this year as well. And so that it may be a temperature thing. It may be a food dynamics thing that's affecting large-scale areas in British Columbia.
So in your estimation, do salmon stocks in BC have the possibility of recovering, or is this an inevitable decline to extinction?
I certainly think that certain things can be done to enhance our hope of a healthy salmon populations. It's a challenge, though. They're good because they're... It's in the environmental field, sometimes we think of these populations as being faced with death of a thousand cuts, where they're actually being impacted in so many different ways that we don't know where to start to try to save these salmon, basically. So they're being impacted when they go into the river, into the freshwater systems, because there's so much development going on along the rivers. The water temperatures are changing as well. We see increases in temperature, which may stress fish. Fish overfishing may be a contributing factor in some areas. So there are a whole host of stressors that may be causing declines on a large scale. I think there are a number of things that we can do. I think one of them has to do with the management body that oversees our wild salmon stocks, and that's Fisheries and Oceans Canada. I think with regards to the Fraser River stocks, I think there has to be some sort of public science review of what happened, because right now we're not really hearing a whole lot from Fisheries and Oceans Canada about what happened, and we'd like to get some more details and some answers, but we're just not getting that at this time. I think there are other ways that we can improve the management of BC's wild salmon. For example, the sockeye run is approaching its end at this point in time, and the pink salmon run in the Fraser River is beginning at this point, and there likely will be a commercial fishery for pink salmon when the sockeye are still coming in. So if there is a directed fishery at pink salmon, it's likely that the commercial fleets will also catch and kill sockeye, which are at devastatingly low numbers. So that's an impact there that we can control. We can help salmon out in that respect. Another way is there's so much evidence out there from Canada, from Europe, that has shown that there are negative impacts from salmon farms on marine habitat and wild salmon. Okay. So I would also think that we can also do something there pretty quickly. We could remove some of these salmon farms that are in salmon migration areas.
Well, that gives us a whole bunch of things to think about, ways we can help the salmon out. Thanks for being with us tonight.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Okay, bye.
Bye.
Thanks, Megan, for bringing us that story. It's time for a break, but please stay with us. Up next, we'll be bringing you coverage of more local news. Stay tuned. This is News 101.
Carrie, darling, Carrie Brown, I cried. If I can't marry Carrie Brown, believe I'd rather die.
You have wandered into the folk oasis. Welcome to it.
Stop the world and let me on.
You are indeed listening to CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
I've been trying to keep my mouth shut, baby. I've been trying to change my dark ways, maybe.
Yes, 8 to 10 p.m. every Wednesday night. It's me, Val, hosting 2 hours of eclectic roots music.
Last night, I left the bar. I was thirsty, and I don't drink wine. I was desperate. I needed blood. I turned to the only place I could. The only place that could possibly help me.
Hello? Canadian Blood Services.
Hello. I need some blood. A. Positive or negative, it doesn't matter.
I'm sorry, we're all out of A positive and negative. Would you like some O instead?
No. No, that won't do. Thank you. Good night. Save me. Save yourself. Give blood. Voluntarily.
This message was brought to you courtesy of the Canadian Blood Services and CITR Radio 101.9 FM.
Hi, this is Mick from Bell and Sebastian, and you're listening to CITR 101.9 FM.
You're listening to News 101, broadcasting live from the Student Union Building at UBC. Thanks for being with us tonight. A few weeks ago, we brought you a story on the BC Rail scandal, the allegations of corruption against Premier Gordon Campbell, who, it's claimed, sold valuable contracts to BC Rail, an important campaign contributor, for file sale prices, a deal which also netted one of Campbell's aides $300,000. For an update on the story and other current issues in provincial politics, our own Andrew Longhurst speaks to Attorney General Opposition Critic Leonard Krog.
On Thursday, I spoke with Leonard Krog, the NDP opposition critic for the Attorney General from the Legislature in Victoria. We discussed recent events in the ongoing BC Rail case, particularly the role of BC Liberal insider Patrick Kinsella.
The BC Rail case, and it is properly described as a case, continues. The trial formally hasn't started yet. Madam Justice Bennett has announced she is recusing herself from the trial. She will not be the trial judge, and we're awaiting the appointment of a trial judge. The next major application is this Monday, August 31st. Defense counsel are arguing that they want the right to cross-examine Patrick Kinsella, a well-known Liberal insider who certainly was working for BC Rail at the time of the transaction and the sale, but is alleged to have been working likewise for CN at the same time, and that's what the defense wished to cross-examine him about.
Can you talk a bit more about Mr. Kinsella's role and why it matters in this case so much?
Well, the defense essentially alleges that they, the accused, were really just following government orders, that they did nothing quote-unquote wrong. They were simply taking direction, and that Mr. Kinsella had a role in the sale of the railway as a close friend of the Premier, a well-known Liberal friend and insider, fundraiser, etc. And so they want to cross-examine him, presumably to elicit from him evidence that would support their basic defense. And that has always been pretty clear from the start that that's what it's about. The problem is that it is now 5.5 years since the unprecedented raid on the legislature, years since the charges were laid, and the possibility of the case being and the charges being dismissed ahead of the trial grow with each passing month. So it's a tough thing for British Columbians who are angry about the broken promise by Gordon Campbell to sell their railway to face the prospect that this thing may never actually see the light of day in a courtroom.
If we reach that point, what happens next? Where do we go from there?
If the case is dismissed, and presumably the special prosecutor doesn't appeal that decision, then the opposition, and I certainly on behalf of the official opposition, have called for a full public inquiry into the sale of BC Rail to cover all aspects of the sale, the involvement, the allegations of corruption, everything to deal with it. The likelihood of Gordon Campbell ordering or the Attorney General directing that public inquiry, I would say, is pretty slim.
That was going to be my next question. Is what? Yeah, is there any support from the government?
Oh, the government has done everything it can to delay this trial. In my view, notwithstanding the many promises of the Premier to be open about this and to cooperate fully, it's clear now, according to the latest application in court and the information given by Mr. Copley, the cabinet's lawyer, that all of the emails, the most relevant emails to this, 2002, 2003, when the government was supposedly doing a core review and negotiating the sale of the railway, those emails are gone or good.
Well, and that's one of the things we were talking about a month ago, is that I think August 17th they were saying that the emails would be released, and there was quite a bit of trouble actually finding those emails, and I thought that was particularly interesting, and I don't know if you have any more thoughts on that.
Well, the interesting thing is, as we discussed, the initial affidavit, particularly of Rosemary Harris, I believe her name is, said, look, the emails are gone. Then there was a second affidavit filed in the proceeding in which she said, well, the order to destroy them was given during the election, and it wasn't clear whether they were or weren't destroyed. Then Mr. Copley provided a whole series of further affidavits in the proceeding, which were reviewed earlier this month in application before Justice Bennett. And it's clear that we're still in the process of attempting to retrieve further emails, that they weren't all destroyed, certainly the ones from 2004 on, but reiterated that the ones from 2000 to 2003, the crucial ones, the ones which would hopefully provide a defense for the accused and reveal exactly the role of the Premier and the Premier's office and everyone else in this, frankly, corrupt deal, those are gone. Okay.
Mr. Krogh also commented on Tuesday's throne speech, which outlined the government's priorities for this legislative session.
After having heard so many liberal throne speeches, both outside the legislature, when I was in private life, and back in for the last 4 years, candidly, it's just another list of promises to mm-hmm. be broken. And in this year, at least they had the decency to shorten the list of the throne speeches down from a record 39 pages from February of this year down to 20 pages. The Liberals are in trouble. They're in deep trouble. Their percentage of popular support has gone from 46 in the election roughly down to 34. People are using the term publicly, calling them liars. I don't think they have any credibility.
In addition, we discussed the controversial harmonized sales tax and how he believes the HST will affect British Columbians. Why do you think the Premier decided to introduce HST at this point in time?
Because
what's the reasoning behind that?
It's early in the mandate. You know, he's got 4 years to let British Columbians forget it. When they say 4 years of deficit, I said yesterday in the legislature, I guarantee one thing. In the fourth year of this government's mandate, they will magically balance the budget and say, look, we've done so much better and been so fiscally responsible and so good, we deserve to be reelected.
Mm.
I don't believe anything they say.
Mm.
The opposition's position is this may be the one time the government will back down. The public outrage around this is huge. The amount of emails, phone calls, letters I'm receiving in my office, and I know other MLAs are getting the same sort of response, is enormous. Collected well over 1,000 signatures at a booth at the Van Crowland exhibition in Nanaimo this weekend past. I think that this government may back down. There is that possibility. So people need to push. They need to sign on the online petition. They need to write and phone their MLAs, particularly if they have Liberal MLAs. And if they live in a riding represented by a New Democrat, let the New Democrat know, of course, but the riding next door that may be represented by a Liberal, make sure you phone their office, too.
Is the Premier trying to get at a transfer of wealth here with HST?
Look, this is a gift to larger corporations who are export-based. This is no benefit to ordinary British Columbians or to British Columbia's small businesses. This is a benefit to the big companies. This is a benefit to Teck Cominco, perhaps, but it is not a benefit to the average British Columbian whatsoever. This is more of Mr. Campbell's tax shifting, which has been going on, helping exacerbate the growing gap between the rich and the poor. I mean, I describe this as the new Gilded Age, you know, where you've got a smaller and smaller class of wealthy and a growing class of poor. And, you know, in the United States, that was followed eventually by the election of Teddy Roosevelt and legislation that broke up the big trusts.
And thanks to Andrew for bringing us that interview. We're going to take a quick break, but stay tuned. National News is next, talking to Green Party leader Elizabeth May about her new book. You're listening to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
I'm going to be around my vegetables. I'm going to chow down my vegetables. I love you most of all, my favorite vegetable.
Sprouts.
It's your 75-cent coffee fix in the sub.
It's your source for reasonably priced, creatively named stew and vegan brownies.
It's your purveyor of bicycle-delivered local produce.
It's also a place where volunteers can realize their vision of responsible business and where like-minded students can explore UBC's food systems.
Hark! Sprouts is currently accepting applications for next year's executive board and is encouraging ambitious, creative, and disciplined students from all faculties and year levels to apply.
Come by Sprouts in the sub-basement to learn more about our projects and how to get involved.
I tried to kick the ball, but my tinny flew right off. I'm red as a beet, 'cause I'm so embarrassed.
At Dunkin' Donuts, each and every
radio show
is brewed fresh and served fresh at the peak of its flavor. If you're a tough customer, only the taste of this
radio show
will do. So go ahead, let Dunkin' Donuts make your
radio experience
exquisite.
Indeed.
Dunkin' Donuts, serving sweet treats from the pop underground. Thursdays, noon to 1.
Since you listen to CITR, everyone knows you've got excellent taste in music. You've probably got a great record collection too. But think of all the money you've spent on music over the years. You're probably just waiting until your next paycheck to get new albums you want to hear, aren't you?
Well, it's time you start getting the discounts you deserve. With the Friends of CITR card, get up to 15% off of Beat Street, Vinyl, Scratch, Red Cat, and Audiopile Records, as well as 16 other great local businesses. Friends cards are only $15 or free with the CITR station membership. Become a friend of CITR. Go to www.citr.ca and click Friends of for more details.
Carrie, darling, Carrie, Carrie Brown, I cried. If I can't marry Carrie Brown, believe I'd rather die.
You have wandered into the folk oasis. Welcome to it.
Stop the world and let me on.
You are indeed listening to CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
I've been trying to keep my mouth shut, baby. Change my dark ways, maybe.
Yes, 8 to 10 p.m. every Wednesday night. It's me, Val, hosting 2 hours of eclectic roots music.
I went downstairs to hear the sound. Broken, lean, and singing song and night.
Folk Oasis.
This is News 101, and the current time is 5:31. The leader of the Green Party, Elizabeth May, has recently released a book of her own, her musings on the state of politics today. With the interview, we go to our friends at Radio Nanaimo.
I love this book. Yes, authors sometimes feel like this. It's like they're having it's the new baby. But this is my seventh book.
Oh, is it?
And
wow.
It's the first one that's not on an environmental theme, being about the crisis in Canadian democracy. But I really feel passionately about this book, and I hope people will have a look, especially in BC with the importance of the STV vote.
Yes, that's on our political, we get to vote on that one this time around,
and,
I believe.
And I'm hoping, of course, desperately hoping that British Columbians pass by more than 60%. And really what you'll be doing is striking a blow for democracy across Canada, because my thesis in the book is that we're in big trouble.
Just talk about it then, Elizabeth. Tell us about the crisis.
Yeah, well, if you look at indicators of a healthy democracy, kind of like looking at a physical of the body politic, how are we doing? Well, 58% of Canadians voted October 14th, 2008. That's the lowest voter turnout in the history of our country, and it's been declining steadily since the early 90s. That's a very bad sign. Particularly bad is the voter turnout among young people is even lower. But still, I 58% of the total Canadian populace voting is a very dangerous sign. The other thing that I think is indicative of a real crisis in our democracy is that we don't really have functioning governments anymore. We have electioneering at all times. We have this nonstop, 24-hour, negative, toxic partisanship. And I used to work in the Mulroney government. Years ago, I was 86 to 88, I worked in a government where we worked with people in the opposition parties. We had great collaboration across party lines. And that is really, that change to nonstop partisanship, elbows out, blood sport, nastiness in politics is very destructive. And I think that's part of the reason that people are voting less. So you take another indicator I look at is how can we have a fully functioning democracy when it's accepted that the RCMP intervened in the 2005-2006 election in a way that affected the outcome of the election, and we've never had an inquiry that forced Commissioner Zaccardelli to explain himself. He's never given a statement or explained it. So there are a number of indicators, but when you look at the civic engagement, the sense of voter satisfaction, that their vote makes a difference, this dreadful first-past-the-post system is the biggest obstacle. And if the voters in B.C. can strike a blow for better voting systems by passing single transferable vote, the STV, that will help all Canadians. I just can't tell you how much people from coast to coast are hoping that this will pass here.
What brought us to this state of affairs, your opinion?
There's some steady trends that are worrying. One of them has been the expanding power of the Prime Minister's office, first against declining powers of individual MPs, and individual MPs lost power as against the powers of a cabinet. So for a while we had cabinet government. It got very strong. For Winston Churchill, it was the war cabinet that changed the way the Westminster tradition in Britain worked. And the same thing, Mackenzie King had a cabinet because the war required that you make decisions not through everybody in the House of Commons. Well, centralization of power is a trend, and it kept going. So now we have the Prime Minister makes all the decisions, and his cabinet members are basically just decorative. They don't really fill any role at all. So the trends of centralization of power, and in the Canadian system being parliamentary democracy, we don't have checks and balances. We don't, unlike the United States, they don't elect a president and then have a legislative branch in the Congress. In parliamentary democracy, the government, as elected, isn't the prime minister. It's 308 MPs, and the government, as elected, can pick a prime minister. But that role used to be first among equals, and the trends to centralization of power have just swept this along, accelerating rapidly, given the kind of perpetrates of Stephen Harper. The situation's gotten much worse. But I look at it and think, if we don't wake Canadians up to what's going on, we could have, the next prime minister comes in the doors of 24 Sussex Drive. Is he really going to say, gee, I have too much power? This was a terrible thing. So the trends will be addressed most effectively by seeing a change in the voting pattern to get rid of first past the post. But there are other things we need to pay attention to as well, particularly the independence of our news media, the diverse range of voices that you need in a healthy democracy.
We're also joined by Simon Schachner, who's one of the other programmers here at the station. Elizabeth, Simon.
Oh, hello.
Hi, Simon. Nice to meet you.
Simon ran for city council in Nanaimo in our last local civic election.
Good for you. Excellent.
You have a question on STV?
Oh, right. Yeah. I totally agree with you about the crisis in Canadian democracy. That's been a major concern for me for years, and I'm really glad you wrote that book. STV, however, I'm a little concerned about because of having such large ridings. It seems to me it would make it very difficult for an independent to be able to really, have the resources to campaign properly in such a huge riding, or even for the smaller grassroots parties, perhaps even parties like the Green Party. I mean, you really would need much more resources, I would think. Do you have any thoughts on that aspect of it?
I've talked to Greens who are successful under the STV system in other countries. My friend Senator Bob Brown is leader of the Australian Greens. He happens to come from the state in Australia, Tasmania, that's had STV the longest. They've had it there. I hadn't realized 100 years of STV voting, and it's because that's what they're used to. I said, well, is it a problem with bigger rights? And now, he's very happy with how it works. And the Irish Greens, now it's newer in Ireland, but they also, right now they've got a coalition government in Ireland, and the Green Party is part of the coalition government. The Minister of Environment in Ireland is a Green Party member of Parliament. It's what you're used to, I suppose. It doesn't look, if you're strong in your own area, say you only campaigned in the same riding in which you'd always been known, you're likely to get it. If you're popular enough to win there, you're still going to win. I think, given the way that seven seats are elected within a larger area, if you're very popular there, you're still going to win there. The efficacy of your vote, if you will, the fact that every vote counts, and if your first choice is a hands-down winner, the vote count will immediately go to your second choice and your third. So no votes are wasted. Overall, this will do quite a lot to assist smaller parties. But I don't think that you'll want to get the word out in a larger area. But, of course, that just changes the way parties campaign as well. Political parties like the Greens can do more to help candidates in a cluster of ridings. Individual candidates can cover more ground. It changes how many doors you want to knock on. But I think the way campaigns are now run, certainly viral campaigns, radio coverage would certainly cover the entire area. It's not such a large riding that your major forms of media don't reach into those places anyway.
Elizabeth May, I know that you have to leave shortly to go to Faulkner Books to sign some books there and talk with people over at the Port Place Shopping Center. Before you go, I'm wondering if I could ask you one more question. You made history when you were given a place at the table during the leaders' debates in the recent federal election, and I remember watching that. I remember very well. You showed up to find that Stephen Harper had reference notes to guide him. Now, this is striking, as I read about it in an article about your book. Tell us about that.
It was a shock. We were told very clearly that no leader would be allowed any notes at all. And we were told that, that my team had to go in ahead of time and look at the table. And I said, there's sort of this little lower table just out of view can hold a glass of water, and there will be blank index cards, and the leaders can jot notes if they want, but the blank index cards are all you're going to have. You can't bring any reference materials in with you. And Stephen Harper was sitting to my left in the French debate, and I just happened to look over and saw that he had very surreptitiously on that table to the left of his left knee, there were index cards, all right, but they weren't the same size as mine. I had these big cards that were provided by the consortium, by the media, and he had little 3x5 cards, and moreover, they had printer font on them. They weren't anything he could have written himself during the debate. And I thought, good grief. And racing through my mind was, do I say something right now? Like, I think he's breaking the rules, excuse me, or that just, and since my goal in political life has been to help focus on issues, get our minds off meaningless distractions like his sweater or, somebody's lost luggage. All this nonsense. We want to talk about issues. So I chose not to, but I did go to the media consortium then as the next night's debate began, and I took aside one of the key people, and I said, last night, you should know, one of the leaders had note cards. And they said, no, really? And they were they're horrified and shocked. And I said, yes, I thought you'd want to know. Strangely enough, and this part wasn't in the media, at the next, that night, so the French debate, he'd had the notes. English debate, I started by letting them know I'd seen this. And when we sat down at the table for the English language debates, Mr. Harper had his notes and was more flagrant in displaying them to me. And Mr. Duceppe had notes. I thought, the consortium is covering for Mr. Harper. And they've told Mr. Duceppe, by all means, bring your notes. They certainly didn't tell the Greens that I could bring any notes. So that's another problem that I hope the book shines a bit of a light on what's going on when something as important to our elections as the national leaders' debates takes place being run by these five news directors for five big networks who have no written rules, have no statutory guidance, decide on very subjective grounds, and of course in the last election decided to keep me out based on blackmailing threats from Mr. Harper and Mr. Layton. I really think, I agree with the CBC news director, past news director Tony Berman. I quote him a lot in my book. He is now working for a different outside of Canada network. He said, you know, we've got to pull the plug on this. We need an independent commission. We need something arm's length. The media consortium really doesn't have the legitimacy to run these debates anymore. And we'll see what happens. I'd like to see some discussion of this before I end up back in the same boat trying to defend why I should be in the debates with a very, very murky, shall we, to put it mildly, process for choosing what leaders go in the debates. And again, I don't know whether Mr. Harper was given different rules than I was given. I find it bizarre that he had notes in the debates.
That's a good point.
That's an interesting little vignette you just shared with us. Shared with us there. Elizabeth May is in the studio with us here. She's going to be at Falconer Books promoting her book, Losing Confidence, Power Politics, and the Crisis in Canadian Democracy. And it sounds like we should all read it and in preparation for our upcoming provincial election, which hopefully will not be pathetically at 58%
well,
of the population.
Well, I think, you know, you have to look at, too, look at the province of Alberta, last election, 40% of people voted. This is a serious crisis, and I just, everybody listening, please, if you think you don't understand STV enough to vote yes, find someone who does understand it. Work hard at getting to where you're very happy to help all Canada and vote yes, because we need the STV vote to pass here to revitalize democracy everywhere else, because I think once you do it, everyone else will follow.
Thank you very much for that push, too. I mean, we did have a segment of our show on that issue with people who are promoting it. So, yeah, I really appreciate your passion.
Thank you. Well, it's like CPR on democracy. Democracy is sick in Canada, and what the doctor's ordering is the STV vote. We really need it. Thanks so much.
Thanks very much.
Thanks, Elizabeth.
Thank you.
Elizabeth May is the leader of the Green Party of Canada. She is on a cross-country book tour promoting her new book, Losing Confidence, Power Politics, and the Crisis in Canadian Democracy.
It's time for another break. Up next is Arts Reviews from the Vancouver Queer Film Festival. You're listening to CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
Hi everyone, we're from the UBC Food Society.
Yummy!
And we're the only food club at UBC.
We're about feeding students, but also teaching them how to feed themselves. Through our restaurant outings and cooking workshops, we hope to expose you guys to the diversity of cultures, flavors, and food communities Vancouver has to offer.
So if you want to get involved, email us at foodsociety@gmail.com or check up on our website at www.ams.ubc.ca/clubs/foodsociety, or you can even join our Facebook group.
The CRTC is asking the public for comments as part of a nationwide review of campus and community radio. That review includes this station. We're asking that you let the CRTC know what local, nonprofit, volunteer-driven radio means to you and your community. Maybe you're a fan of community radio. Maybe you've donated. Or maybe you're a volunteer. Then please write to the CRTC and make sure you tell them you support the idea of stable funding for the sector. To submit your comments, visit the website crtc.notlong.com and look for review number 418, the review of campus and community radio. The last day for comments is Friday, October 16th.
CITR 101.9 FM and Union Events present Classified, a Nova Scotian award-winning rapper with Australian group Hilltop Hoods. You've heard his hit single Anybody Listening from his newest album Self-Explanatory. Now hear him live on Wednesday, September 9th at 8 o'clock at the venue, 881 Granville Street. Tickets on sale now.
I'm Peter Mansbridge, and you're listening to CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
Right now it's 5:46 and time for the Arts Report. Instead of a traditional arts report this week, we're bringing you special coverage of the Queer Film Festival. Both Megan and I attended films at the festival. Megan saw City of Borders and The Port Side, and I attended Fruit Fly. So, Megan, what did you think about the films you saw this week, or last week?
Well, one of them I enjoyed a lot, and the other one
was less than enjoyable, I guess. I was pretty bored. Hi, mixed bag from the Queer Film Festival.
All right, so tell me a little bit about each of them.
Well, I went to go see The City of Borders. Director Yun Sun travels to one of the most polarized places on Earth, Jerusalem, and takes a look at the binaries and contradictions there that both divide and bring people together. The film follows a group of gays and lesbians as they navigate a world where it's not easy being queer. There's Booty, the devout Muslim drag queen, Samara and Ravit, a Jewish Arab lesbian couple, Adam, a former soldier who is building a new house in an Israeli settlement with his boyfriend, and Sahar, who's the first and only openly gay member of Jerusalem City Council. So, but despite the heavy subject matter and the dangers of being gay in this intensely religious city, City of Borders manages to find the humor in everyday life. In one incident, Booty is forced to move to the United States because of threats against his life by intensely religious Muslims. And he talks to a mall Santa who's just being friendly and says, oh, he's been to Palestine too, but after further questioning, it turns out he's been to Morocco. So Sun isn't there to make any pronouncements on the Israeli-Palestine conflict. So many of the characters have differing views about this, about the conflict, and he's sympathetic and shows, I guess, the views of each one. But there is an attempt to expose the intense homophobia that exists on both sides of the fence in Jerusalem. One interesting thing about this film was how the gay-straight binary helped to cross other barriers. So the ultra-Orthodox Jewish community and the religious Muslims and Christians were united in hating the homosexuals and violently protesting gay pride. One of the characters, Adam, is actually stabbed at a gay pride parade, but he returns the next year. Yes, pretty courageously of him. And also the Palestinian and Israeli LGBTQ community is quite united. There's only one gay bar in all of Jerusalem, so everyone parties together there, I guess. So the film took 7 years to produce, and after watching it, I felt like there was a lot more deeper story here, and each character could probably have their own film. So that said, I learned a lot from this film, and I laughed a lot, and I really enjoyed it.
Was it a documentary?
It was a documentary-style film, yeah. The other film I saw was The Port Side, and it was this year's Queer History Project film. And that's each year the project commissions a film about queer history, and so the idea is to create a place that showcases the history of a group which faces barriers to the general transfer of knowledge of its own history, because obviously queer parents aren't necessarily having queer children, and they're not passing that history along. So this year, they commissioned a poet and a director to collaborate on a movie, and what they came up with was The Port Side. And it was essentially an impression of the Vanport Hotel Bar in 1974, which was a popular lesbian bar in the 70s in East Vancouver. But it lacked a lot of plot. It was more of a series of vignettes centering around different tables at the bar, and there wasn't particularly very engaging dialogue. They're just people hanging out at a bar, talking. The deepest the film got was some brief mentions of workplace discrimination of queer people and of closeted relationships. Otherwise, there wasn't very much character development or telling any particular story. It didn't really follow the plot line that your elementary school teacher wanted you to do, with a beginning, a climax, and end, instead of just people talking at a bar. So overall, I found it to be an overly indulgent piece of nostalgia. And I'm not really sure that this is the type of film a queer history project should be doing, because I didn't feel like it told us a lot about what it was like to be gay in Vancouver in the 70s. It was more just, we used to hang out at a bar, and that was awesome, and let's all like remember what it was like to be 20 and hang out in a bar. So I guess if you weren't someone who frequented lesbian bars in the 1970s and you don't have fond memories of that time, it's just kind of has, it doesn't have a lot of meaning, it doesn't tell you a lot, and so I didn't feel like I got a lot of out of it, and yeah, I don't see this as a good way to learn more about Vancouver's queer history. It just seemed very nondescript. How did you feel about the film you saw?
Well, unfortunately, I wasn't very impressed with the film I saw either. I saw Fruit Fly. It is a musical about a Filipino-American woman who is new to San Francisco and trying to make her way as a performance artist, and she moves into a communal living space. And so it's her personal journey towards trying to be successful and trying to find meaning in her art, and also just her her new friends and friendships and her experience living in the Castro in San mm-hmm. Francisco. For me, I think what the film lacked was a coherent focus. They tried to touch on too many issues and not really deeply enough on any of them. The Filipino-American woman is... her art centers around her struggles with her identity. Her parents in the Philippines left her, and she was raised by adopted parents in the States, and so she's trying to reconcile those things and mm-hmm. discover herself. As cliched as that is, there's a plot line with the roommates of what it is to be homosexual and young, even in a really already established community like the Castro in San Francisco. More general plot lines about just discovering yourself and being true to yourself. None of it really went anywhere. There wasn't any resolution to any of these issues. The music seemed slightly half-baked. The protagonist, the Filipino-American woman, isn't gay herself. The rest of the inhabitants of the house are gay. And she's termed a fag hag because she enjoys hanging out with them. Which is, sure, whatever. But... that idea wasn't explored very deeply. Mm-hmm. Like, if the filmmakers were trying to explore what it means to be a fag hag and whether that's still relevant today, they didn't really accomplish that. And so it just... I went to the film with some friends, mm-hmm. and some of the people who accompanied me felt they liked the film much more than I did, and they identified with the struggle of being an artist, and especially performing artist, I think, more. Mm-hmm. So maybe that affected my enjoyment, but just in general, I was kind of puzzled at what the filmmaker was trying to say. It didn't seem very relevant to me. Mm-hmm. I'm from San Francisco. I've been to the Castro a whole lot. It was a really edgy, exciting place in the 70s. Mm-hmm. Now it's just another urban neighborhood, at least in my experience, and maybe with a slightly higher proportion of gay people, but it's not quite, you're not really saying a whole lot by putting it in the Castro. And is gay identity just fag hags and picking up at clubs and being bohemian? I'm not sure about that. It seemed kind of hackneyed, and it wasn't pushing the boundaries or saying anything new.
Well, you're talking about cliches. I was actually going to say that I was presently surprised by the diversity of films. Like, I expected just to see a series of different coming out films in, like, set in different locations, basically, mm-hmm. and, like, a lot of teen angst, a lot of, I guess, maybe just angst in general. And I was surprised that about the diversity of films I saw.
For sure. And also, I spoke with one of the organizers of the festival, and she said that part of the goal is to sort of cross and have cross-pollination between the gay male community and the lesbian community. And so trying to pick films which appeal to a broader audience of homosexuals and which might bring people together. And so in that sense, this film, Fruit Fly, there were lesbians in it, there were gay males, there were straight people. In that sense, it was very inclusive. which I, you know, I appreciated. Mm-hmm. And also talking about being gay from an Asian American perspective was of interest. But I don't know. Maybe I picked the wrong film, unfortunately. So I think that's it for our arts report. We're going to go to a quick PSA break, and we'll be back with your weekend weather forecast.
Ever thought about volunteering with Big Sisters? Maybe now is the time. Big Sisters of BC Lower Mainland provides girls aged 7 to 17 with a champion, a mentor who's there to simply be their friend and cheer them on. Become a study buddy tutor and spend 1 hour a week helping your little sister learn to love school. Or become a big sister and spend 3 fun hours a week just hanging out with your little sister. If you're age 19 or older, please visit bigsisters.bc.ca to find out more. Maybe now is the time.
Welcome back to News 101. Now it's time for your weekend weather forecast. And for that, here is Alice Wong. Alice?
Thanks, Carrie. Here's your weekend forecast for August 28th to August 31st. We might see a slight change in the weather this weekend as a trough of low pressure brushes past the BC coast. This system will increase cloud cover Friday evening into the overnight. The cold front might create a little bit of atmospheric instability, so there will be a 30% chance of showers this evening with a low of 12 degrees. Saturday will wake up to some clouds and a slight chance of showers as well, but everything should clear up once the tail end of the system passes. Sunday will be back to a more stable atmospheric pattern thanks to a high-pressure system building off the coast of Oregon. Sunday will be mainly sunny with a high of 24 by the water, 28 degrees inland. Monday, it will still be sunny, high of 23 by the water and 27 inland. Next week looks really good. Currently it's 23 degrees and mainly cloudy at YVR. That's your weather this weekend, brought to you by the Storm Club of UBC. For News 101, I'm Alice Wong.
Thanks, Alice. And that's our program for August 28th, 2009. Today's newscast was brought to you entirely by volunteer efforts. If you'd like to share your comments, give us a hot news tip, or get involved with the show, contact us. Our phone number is 604-822-5334, or you can email news@citr.ca. Megan Toccato produced this radio program. For more news, join us next Friday at 5 for another edition of News 101. I'm Carrie Baptist. For the entire news team at CITR, thanks for listening. Stay tuned for Hot Mess here on 101.9 FM CITR.